His invention of the cloud-based ledger allows property rights to be verified without having to depend on some third-party trust agency. The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. What's up, guys? Welcome back. We've got an awesome read today here on Bitcoin Audible. And this is one actually that I both love and kind of really frustrates me at the same time. I'm a big fan of Jeffrey Tucker. I think he was like the head of the Mises Institute for some span of time. I don't know. He's just always been in the Mises circles. He's an editorial director at the American Institute for Economic Research, AIER, AIER.org. And that is where this article is, written by Jeffrey Tucker. But he has tended to come down on the big block side of things. And there's a little bit of a hint of that in this article. So I actually want to kind of push back a little bit on that. But overall, this is a great piece. It's titled, Why Does Bitcoin Have Value? And it's so funny, the main part that I think is the core value of Bitcoin, he dances around through this entire article without actually identifying it. So I feel like he's just on the cusp of the more important thing and never actually explicitly states it. But nonetheless, it's a really great way to think about it from kind of a step back perspective. Before we jump in the read, though, and get Guy's take afterward, let's go ahead and thank our sponsors. We have got three awesome sponsors now fully booked here. We could not literally have a better array of Bitcoin services and tools. We've got the Hexa wallet, mobile wallet. So for your hot wallet and to be able to, you know, separate with multiple accounts on your mobile, Hexa, H-E-X-A is where it's at. Then we've got the cold storage, the BitBox hardware wallet, which is super secure and super simple. I love how easy to use this thing is, the BitBox O2. And then now we've got a free exchange and banking services through Levvl.co. That's LVL.co. And a thank you to those guys, not only for the tools and services that they are making available to the Bitcoin space, but also for bringing Bitcoin Audible to you guys. All right, now let's dig into today's article, and we will talk about this one quite a bit afterward. By Jeffrey Tucker on IR.org. Why does Bitcoin have value? Even after 11 years experience and a per Bitcoin price of nearly $20,000, the incredulous are still with us. I understand why. Bitcoin is not like other traditional financial assets. Even describing it as an asset is misleading. It is not the same as a stock, as a payment system, or a money. It has features of all of these, but it is not identical to them. What Bitcoin is depends on its use as a means of storing and porting value, which in turn rests on secure titles to ownership of a scarce good. Those without experience in the sector look at all of this and get frustrated that understanding why it is valuable is not so easy to grasp. In this article, I'm updating an analysis I wrote 6 years ago. It still holds up. For those who don't want to slog through the entire article, my thesis is that Bitcoin's value obtains from its underlying technology, which is an open source ledger that keeps track of ownership rights and permits the transfer of these rights. Bitcoin managed to bundle its unit of account with a payment system that lives on the ledger. That's its innovation and why it obtained a value, and that value continues to rise. Consider the criticism offered by traditional gold advocates who have, for decades, pushed the idea that sound money must be backed by something real, hard, and independently valuable. Bitcoin doesn't qualify, right? Maybe it does. Bitcoin first emerged as a possible competitor to national, government-managed money in 2009. Satoshi Nakamoto's white paper was released October 31st, 2008. The structure and language of this paper sent the message: this currency is for computer technicians, not economists nor political pundits. The paper's circulation was limited. Novices who read it were mystified. But the lack of interest didn't stop history from moving forward. 2 months later, those who were paying attention saw the emergence of the Genesis block, the first group of Bitcoins generated through Nakamoto's concept of a distributed ledger that lived on any computer node in the world that wanted to host it. Here we are all these years later, and a single Bitcoin trades at $18,500. The currency is held and accepted by many thousands of institutions, both online and offline. Its payment system is very popular in poor countries without vast banking infrastructures, but also in developed countries. And major institutions, including the Federal Reserve, the OECD, the World Bank, and major investment houses, are paying respectful attention and weaving blockchain technology into their operations. Enthusiasts, who are found in every country, say that its exchange value will soar even more in the future because its supply is strictly limited and it provides a system vastly superior to government money. Bitcoin is transferred between individuals without a third party. It is relatively low cost to exchange. It has a predictable supply. It is durable, fungible, and divisible, all crucial features of money. It creates a monetary system that does not depend on trust and identity, much less on central banks and government. It is a new system for the digital age. Hard lessons for hard money. To those educated in the hard money tradition, the whole idea has been a serious challenge. Speaking for myself, I had been reading about Bitcoin for 2 years before I came anywhere close to understanding it. There was just something about the whole idea that bugged me. You can't make money out of nothing, much less out of computer code. Why does it have value then? There must be something amiss. This is not how we expected money to be reformed. That's the problem. Our expectations. We should have been paying closer attention to Ludwig von Mises' theory of money's origins. Not to what we think he wrote, but to what he actually did write. In 1912, Mises released The Theory of Money and Credit. It was a huge hit in Europe when it came out in German, and it was translated into English. While covering every aspect of money, his core contribution was in tracing the value and price of money, and not just money itself, to its origins. That is, he explained how money gets its price in terms of the goods and services it obtains. He later called this process the regression theorem, and as it turns out, Bitcoin satisfies the conditions of the theorem. Mises' teacher, Karl Menger, demonstrated that money itself originates from the market, not from the state and not from social contract. It emerges gradually as monetary entrepreneurs seek out an ideal form of commodity for indirect exchange. Instead of merely bartering with each other, people acquire a good not to consume, but to trade. That good becomes money, the most marketable commodity. But Mises added that the value of money traces backward in time to its value as a bartered commodity. Mises said that this is the only way money can have value. Quote, "The theory of the value of money as such can trace back the objective exchange value of money only to that point where it ceases to be the value of money and becomes merely the value of a commodity. If in this way we continually go farther and farther back, we must eventually arrive at a point where we no longer find any component in the objective exchange value of money that arises from valuations based on the function of money as a common medium of exchange. where the value of money is nothing other than the value of an object that is useful in some other way than as money. Before, it was usual to acquire goods in the market, not for personal consumption, but merely in order to exchange them again for the goods that were really wanted. Each individual commodity was only accredited with that value given by the subjective valuations based on its direct utility. Mises's explanation solved a major problem that had long mystified economists. It is a narrative of conjectural history, and yet it makes perfect sense. Would salt have become money had it otherwise been completely useless? Would beaver pelts have obtained monetary value had they not been useful for clothing? Would silver or gold have had money value if they had no value as commodities first? The answer in all cases of monetary history is clearly no. The initial value of money, before it becomes widely traded as money, originates in its direct utility. It's an explanation that is demonstrated through historical reconstruction. That is Mises's regression theorem. Bitcoin's use value. At first glance, Bitcoin would seem to be an exception. You can't use a Bitcoin for anything other than money. Can't be worn as jewelry. You can't make a machine out of it. You can't eat it or even decorate with it. Its value is only realized as a unit that facilitates indirect exchange. And yet, Bitcoin already is money. It's used every day. You can see the exchanges in real time. It's not a myth. It's the real deal. It might seem like we have to choose. Is Mises wrong? Maybe we have to toss out this whole theory. Or maybe his point was purely historical and doesn't apply in the future of a digital age. Or maybe his regression theorem is proof that Bitcoin is just an empty mania with no staying power, because it can't be reduced to its value as a useful commodity. And yet, you don't have to resort to complicated monetary theory in order to understand the sense of alarm surrounding Bitcoin. Many people, as I did, just have a feeling of uneasiness about a money that has no basis in anything physical. Sure, you can print out a Bitcoin on a piece of paper, but having a paper with a QR code or a public key is not enough to relieve that sense of unease. How can we resolve this problem? In my own mind, I toyed with the issue for more than a year. It puzzled me. I wonder if Mises' insight applied only in a pre-digital age. I followed the speculations online that the value of Bitcoin would be zero, but for the national currencies into which it is converted. Perhaps the demand for Bitcoin overcame the demands of Mises' scenario because of a desperate need for something other than the dollar. As time passed, and I read the work of Conrad Graff, Peter Serda, and Daniel Krawitz, finally the resolution came. Bitcoin is both a payment system and a money. The payment system is the source of value, while the accounting unit merely expresses that value in terms of price. The unity of money and payment is its most unusual feature, and the one that most commentators have had trouble wrapping their heads around. We are all used to thinking of currency as separate from payment systems. This thinking is a reflection of the technological limitations of history. There is the dollar, and there are credit cards. There is the euro, and there is PayPal. There is the yen, and there are wire services. In each case, money transfer relies on third-party service providers. In order to use them, you need to establish what is called a trust relationship with them, which is to say that the institution arranging the deal has to believe that you are going to pay. This wedge between money and payment has always been with us, except for the case of physical proximity. If I give you a dollar for your pizza slice, there is no third party. But payment systems, third parties, and trust relationships become necessary once you leave geographic proximity. That's when companies like Visa and institutions like banks become indispensable. They are the application that makes the monetary software do what you want it to do. The hitch is that the payment systems we have today are not available to just anyone. In fact, a vast majority of humanity does not have access to such tools, which is a major reason for poverty in the world. The financially disenfranchised are confined to only local trade and cannot extend their trading relationships with the world. A major, if not a primary, purpose of developing Bitcoin was to solve this problem. The protocol set out to weave together the currency feature with a payment system. The two are interlinked in the structure of the code itself. This connection is what makes Bitcoin different from any existing national currency and, really, any currency in history. Let Nakamoto speak from the introductory abstract to his white paper. Observe how central the payment system is to the monetary system he created. Quote, "A purely peer-to-peer version of electronic cash would allow online payments to be sent directly from one party to another without going through a financial institution. Digital signatures provide part of the solution, but the main benefits are lost if a trusted third party is still required to prevent double spending. We propose a solution to the double spending problem using a peer-to-peer network. The network timestamps transactions by hashing them into an ongoing chain of hash-based proof of work, forming a record that cannot be changed without redoing the proof of work. The longest chain not only serves as proof of the sequence of events witnessed, but proof that it came from the largest pool of CPU power. As long as a majority of CPU power is controlled by nodes that are not cooperating to attack the network, they will generate the longest chain and outpace attackers. The network itself requires minimal structure. Messages are broadcast on a best effort basis, and nodes can leave and rejoin the network at will, accepting the longest proof of work chain as proof of what happened while they were gone." What's very striking about this paragraph is that there is not even one mention of the currency unit itself. There is only the mention of the problem of double spending, which is to say, the problem of inflationary money creation beyond which the protocol would otherwise permit. The innovation here, even according to the words of its inventor, is the payment network, not the coin. The coin or digital unit only expresses the value of the network. It is an accounting tool that absorbs and carries the value of the network through time and space. This network is the blockchain. It's a ledger that lives in the digital cloud, a distributed network, and it can be observed in operation by anyone at any time. It is carefully monitored by all users. It allows the transference of secure and non-repeatable bits of information from one person to any other person anywhere in the world. And these information bits are secured by a digital form of property title. This is what Nakamoto called digital signatures. His invention of the cloud-based ledger allows property rights to be verified without having to depend on some third-party trust agency. The blockchain solved what has come to be known as the Byzantine Generals problem. This is the problem of coordinating action over a large geographic range in the presence of potentially malicious actors. Because generals separated by space have to rely on messengers, and this reliance takes time and trust, no general can be absolutely sure that the other general has received and confirmed the message, much less its accuracy. Putting a ledger to which everyone has access on the internet overcomes this problem. The ledger records the amounts, the times, and the public addresses of every transaction. The information is shared across the globe and always gets updated. The ledger guarantees the integrity of the system and allows the currency unit to become a digital form of property with a title. Once you understand this, you can see that the value proposition of Bitcoin is bound up with its attached payment network. Here is where you find the use value to which Mises refers. It is not embedded in the currency unit, but rather in the brilliant and innovative payment system on which Bitcoin lives. If it were possible for the blockchain to be somehow separated from Bitcoin, and really this is not possible, the value of the currency would instantly fall to zero. Proof of concept. Now, to further understand how Mises' theory fits with Bitcoin, you have to understand one other point concerning the history of the cryptocurrency. On the day of its release, January 3rd, 2009, the value of Bitcoin was exactly zero. And so it remained for 10 months after its release. All the while, transactions were taking place, but it had no posted value above zero for this entire time. The first posted price of Bitcoin appeared on October 5th, 2009. On this exchange, $1 equaled 1,309.03 Bitcoin, which many considered overpriced at the time. In other words, the first valuation of Bitcoin was little more than 1/10 of a penny. Yes, if you had bought $100 worth of Bitcoin in those days and not sold them in some panic, you would be a half billionaire today. So here's the question. What happened between January 9th and October 5th, 2009 to cause Bitcoin to obtain a market value? The answer is that traders, enthusiasts, entrepreneurs, and others were trying out the blockchain. They wanted to know if it worked. Did it transfer the units without double spending? Did a system that depended on voluntary CPU power actually suffice to verify and confirm transactions? Do the rewarded bitcoins land in the right spot as payment for verification services? And most of all, did this new system actually work to do the seemingly impossible? That is, to move secure bits of title-based information through geographic space, not by using some third party, but rather peer-to-peer. It took 10 months to build confidence. It took another 18 months before Bitcoin reached parity with the US dollar. This history is essential to understand, especially if you are relying on a theory of money's origins that speculates about the prehistory of money, as Mises' regression theorem does. Bitcoin was not always a money with value. It was once a pure accounting unit attached to a ledger. This ledger obtained what Mises called, quote, use value. All conditions of the theorem are thereby satisfied. Final accounting. To review, if anyone says that Bitcoin is based on nothing but thin air, that it cannot be a money because it has no real history as a genuine commodity, and whether the person saying this is a novice or a highly trained economist, you need to bring up two central points. One, Bitcoin is not a standalone currency, but a unit of account attached to an innovative payment network. And two, this network, and therefore Bitcoin, only obtained its market value through real-time testing in a market environment. In other words, once you account for the razzle-dazzle technical features, Bitcoin emerged exactly like every other currency, from salt to gold, did. People found the payment system useful, and the attached accounting was portable, divisible, fungible, durable, and scarce. A new form of money was born. This money has all the best features of money from history, but adds a weightless and spaceless payment network, one that is reliable and verified in real time, that enables the entire world to trade without having to rely on third parties. But notice something extremely important here. The blockchain is not only about money. It is about any information transfers that require security, confirmations, and total assurance of authenticity. This pertains to contracts and transactions of all sorts, all performed peer-to-peer. To be sure, the sector has come to be dominated by third parties that operate mainly as custodians. The crucial point is that this is a market development driven by consumer desire, but it is not necessary for the functioning of the system. In addition, thousands of additional tokens have appeared that operate and compete in the crypto sector, which is now worth, at the time of this writing, $560 billion in market capitalization. Think of a world without essential third parties, including the most dangerous third party ever conceived of by man, the state and the central bank. Imagine that future, and you begin to grasp the fullness of the implications of our future. Ludwig von Mises would be amazed and surprised at Bitcoin, but he might also feel a sense of pride that his monetary theory of more than a century ago has been confirmed and given new life in the 21st century. By Jeffrey Tucker. All right, a great, great piece. There are so many little gold nuggets in this thing, and a lot to unpack. Again, I want to push back a little bit just on the language of payment system, but I really think there are so many things that he brushed up against that show just how valuable the network itself is and why that he doesn't quite explicitly identify. And I think there's just so many great analogies to go into that illustrate how and why Bitcoin has value from so many alternative perspectives or from so many different alternative uses that give it that monetary premium or allow that monetary premium to develop. And it's actually in the combination of so many things, of which the payment system is one of. Or I guess you could say the payment system is kind of a result of these other more critical things that Jeffrey Tucker actually talks about in this piece. But I actually want to go a little bit, like a layer deeper than this article actually goes here in the guy's take. But I need something else to drink. So let's take a quick break and hit our sponsor, and then we will jump right back in. And who do we have today? It's the BitBox. Now, my brother was actually just talking about the other day that he's always had an issue with hardware wallets, with having to trust the company that makes it. And he was saying that he'd always wish he could just get a simple one that was built by an actual, like, well-known Bitcoin developer. And he was like, the BitBox is actually that. It's fully open source code. The company is totally focused on secure hardware run by engineers and founded by those engineers, Douglas Backham and Jonas Schnelli, who many of you know Jonas as a core maintainer of the Bitcoin protocol. In fact, he is number 8 in the number of commits to Bitcoin Core. And they truly have one of the simplest, easy to use, minimal hardware wallets that you can get in Bitcoin. It is the BitBox O2, and you should definitely check it out. The holiday season is right around the corner, and I know a lot of you are going to be getting your first hardware wallets or maybe getting one for a family member. Check out the BitBox at guyswan.com/BitBox. So why does Bitcoin have value? And I think one of the best takeaways from this article is really just the idea that the unit itself is simply attached to an additional architecture. And the value of the system is in the architecture itself, what that architecture and the economic incentives that it builds, what it is able to provide to anyone within that system, and the fact that it is a network and a form of payment system within that architecture. My one nitpick with this article is the constant focus on the payment and the use of the word payment system, which I think can very much confuse the really deep value that this is providing. It is not merely in, which he talks about, like he really hits on so much in this article, and I'll give quote after quote of him basically hitting spot on, or at least kind of brushing right up against what I think really is the core value proposition of Bitcoin. And the reason I think payment system, quote unquote, is not quite the right term is because this is not in, this cannot scale to PayPal levels. This simply can't do that number of transactions. In fact, a really fun little piece of history is that this was essentially the very first response to a Satoshi when he released this on the cryptography mailing list. So the cryptography mailing list and the cypherpunk mailing list were groups of enthusiasts and cryptographers and anarchists and activists and privacy researchers and all these disparate groups of people who were basically aligned in a common cause on the internet. And they created these little communities and created tools for privacy, for protection, for encryption, for security and stuff online, many that we use today. I mean, the people on the Cypherpunks mailing list are literally a who's who of who shaped the internet today. Julian Assange and WikiLeaks was born of there. It had the major developers and creators of the Tor network, had the creator of BitTorrent and you know, online file sharing. It included the group that sued the U.S. government to get basic encryption no longer listed as a munitions, had the inventors of many, if not all, of the precursors of Bitcoin. Like, this is where that problem was trying to be solved in these two communities. Cypherpunk's mailing list kind of died out, and it had become mostly on the cryptography mailing list, and that is where, in 2008, October 31st, that the Bitcoin white paper was released to this community to create a private and decentralized digital cash, which he refers to as, you know, peer-to-peer, but that's essentially what it means, is there's just no central authority in it, and that you do not have any institution of trust that is running the system or determining the system's rules or who owns what. And that was an absolute breakthrough. But what's hilarious is that kind of the whole mailing list, and since this had been going on for like 20 years, they've been trying to solve this problem and they never really figured it out, is that a lot of people on the mailing list and in the community had become kind of jaded about it. Like, they just kind of were giving up at that point. Is everything that came across, they'd seen so many of these proposals now, and none of them really did it, that it was like, another one. You know, there wasn't a whole bunch of fanfare. Like, Bitcoin was basically a nothing burger that got a couple people interested. One of those in particular was the optimist, Hal Finney, who immediately kind of was like, well, this is really interesting. And he, you know, wanted to test it out and tinker with it. But the very first response, to Satoshi was that we very, very, this is a quote, we very, very much need such a system. But the way I understand your proposal, it does not seem to scale to the required size. For transferable proof-of-work tokens to have value, they must have monetary value. To have monetary value, they must be transferred within a very large network. For example, a file trading network akin to BitTorrent. To detect and reject a double spending event in a timely manner, one must have most past transactions of the coins in the transaction, which naively implemented requires each peer to have most past transactions or most past transactions that have occurred recently. If hundreds of millions of people are doing transactions, that is a lot of bandwidth. Each must know all or a substantial part thereof. End quote. That is the very first response to Satoshi's release of the Bitcoin white paper, and it is the very source of the trade-off problem and the thinking about this thing as a payment system or as something that would be used for retail payments that led to the 2015 to 2017 fork wars. That all the transactions in the world are supposed to be crammed into this thing, when the very nature of its ability to have integrity in doing that job, the very reason we can easily check and know that double spins haven't been made, that the inflation is accurate, that the property titles go exactly to the owners of the proper owners of the title. The only reason we have assurances of any of those things is because we can check it, is because we can do the math from start to finish. If you can't go all the way back to when the Bitcoin was created, you have no idea if it's real Bitcoin, because that is how you determine what is a real Bitcoin versus not, is checking the entire history against the rules of the system. So it's just really funny to see the scaling problem, what would be essentially a civil war inside of Bitcoin, almost a decade later, was right at the first, you know, the first days that Bitcoin was even announced to the world. Like, we just kind of had the foreshadowing of all the issues that were going to be contentious about the direction and future of this protocol. So that's my one complaint about this whole article. But otherwise, it's an incredibly good way to imagine why it's not just a digital point. It's a digital point inside an entire architecture that can provide utility, that can provide value that nothing else can provide anywhere. So let's dig into some of his examples here. And my favorite analogy, which he leans on a lot in this piece, is the concept of a property title, is that this mimics the idea of physically owning a thing in the digital space. But even more importantly, it stipulates and enforces the content of the contract, like what the property title itself says, and whatever conditions you attach to it, the network itself will actually read and execute according to those instructions. So how do we think about why that has value? Value that's not merely in the payment or the exchange of the thing, but in the fact that you know the title remains the title from today, yesterday, tomorrow, a year from now, etc. What is the value of a law? Like, literally, the law itself. How do you define the value of having a set of rules that we all adhere to in order to do business? There's always a set of standards, right? There's you can engage in this sort of activity and you can't engage in this sort of activity. This is how we check to make sure that we are honest in this agreement. This is the third party we use as an escrow, an independent agent, et cetera, et cetera. What are the value of these things? How do you define how much it is worth to have that clear set of rules as opposed to not having it? Where it's a completely abstract idea, but we do put costs on it. We do pay exorbitant costs for establishing standards and regulations and laws. In fact, you could arguably say that as inefficient and horrible as government is at corrupting those things, it's still more beneficial to have partially bad laws than it is to have no laws, simply because it creates that standard so that we can actually do business, so that we can, like, even if there's something stupid that we have to go around, as long as we know that everybody is on the same page, everybody's speaking the same rules, and everybody knows that the exact same things are being enforced, suddenly an economy can emerge, a market can actually be created. What would be the price tag of that? What about the price of a court? What about the price of the U.S. court system? Let's say it's not a monopoly through government, but it's an arbitration system. What would be the price of it to be able to go to court and show the title, produce a title to some sort of a good or to some subset of value or to some agreement, and know that according to the written word of that title, according to the instructions of that title, that the court would execute it justly, that you are the owner, that it is according, because the title says you are the owner, that it definitely is, and that court was not corruptible, that you couldn't pay the judge under the table or, you know, give his wife's charity, $100 million without, nudge, nudge. What would be the value of a court that could not be corrupted and always to the letter of the title, executed 100% fairly every single contract that got pushed through the court. For that matter, what's the value of the contract itself, of the clarity of that contract? Like, knowing that there's no ambiguity written in the language, how much do we pay lawyers to write perfect contracts, to make sure that they use their legal expertise to make sure that it is rock solid and there is no edge case or weird scenario in which that title doesn't belong to us because we were too close to the ditch or we were didn't fill out this paperwork or something like that? What's the value of the security of the title? That the language used is in fact the language that's executed as it is intended. We pay bukus of money for those things, but there's no explicit price tag because it's an abstract idea. There's never been a way to attach it to some explicit unit that we could then value in relation to the utility that those things are providing us. You know, there's no like court points that, you know, we could use to value what the U.S. court system is actually worth. What about the price, or what about the value of a bank? Just a bank in general. Not even necessarily in like the Visa debit card side, but in being able to keep your funds safe and to know that that bank isn't cheating you. That, like, what's the value of being able to audit that bank? Because the original purpose, or one of the original services that a bank would provide, is that it would make your money more mobile, right? Is that you could deposit gold into the bank and then they would give you bank notes. Like, this is where the gold standard came from, is that the notes and the coins were much easier to exchange than the actual physical gold was. But the assurances, the reliability and the value of your bank was how well it tied its operations to how much actual gold there was in the bank, i.e. it did not double spend, right? It did not create new units from nothing. It created them based on a very explicit set of rules and a very explicitly scarce good that was backing it. But, you know, what is that? Just that service alone, what's that worth? The honesty and integrity of a bank that you know isn't cheating. What would somebody pay for that? To have absolute proof that all of the rules are being followed within that institution. There are no imbalances. There is no rehypothecation. What's that worth? To know there's no way on earth for that institution to become insolvent. Would that carry a premium over other banks, you think? And he uses the words property and property titles and property rights, which, again, I think really is the core way to understand what Bitcoin is. What if you could know that the Constitution was followed to the letter? What if you could take some explicit set of rules within the Constitution and you could translate that into an algorithm? Let's just say property rights. Let's say life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, and property are guaranteed rights under some new constitution. It's property is one of those explicit rights. What would it be worth to have a country that could algorithmically prove that turned property rights into a math equation, that turned ownership authority into something that was outside the rule of the courts, the politicians, the government itself, that it ripped that out of the Constitution and says, this is guaranteed. Everything else is left up to the social sphere, but this cannot be contested. You either have the solution to this math problem, or you don't. And if you do, you are the owner of the property title. If you do not, you are not. No commerce laws, no eminent domain, no civil asset forfeiture, all that crap is out the window, and it's replaced with a math problem that says yes or no. You are the rightful owner. What is that worth? People pack up their entire families, their entire lives. They leave worlds behind, friends, jobs, careers, houses, like all sorts of things behind to find a place in the world in which those rights are better guaranteed. People give up everything to find that level of assurance. It's not easy to put a price tag on that. Bitcoin is a combination of all of the previous examples I just gave. It is an explicit set of laws, financial laws, that cannot be cheated. It is an explicit title to property with no master who has the ability to change or alter it, or that is dependent on agreeing with the title. It's a set of rules that govern that property, a sort of limited constitution that applies only to these units called Bitcoin, that have no jurisdiction and is provably free of corruption and violation. It is a bank in the digital space that you know is perfectly auditable at all times of the day, and where there is zero risk whatever, because you can prove it yourself on your computer, that it cannot and will not, under any circumstances, become insolvent. It is an exchange system that allows us to securely send and receive these property titles without any trusted middleman. It is also a court system executing the language of these contracts and protecting all rightful owners with the most sound and unambiguous legal language that can be written. The objective yes-no output of a mathematical function. It is a monetary system that is precise almost beyond believability. It is subject to no subjective economist or politician's vision of how much money we might need based on which way the wind is blowing. It solves Hayek's pretense of knowledge problem by just removing humans from the equation. We are all subjective. We are all corruptible. We are all ignorant. Therefore, we should not be in charge of the money. That's why gold used to work, why it ended up failing, and why fiat sucks so bad. So here is a set of monetary rules and property rights that exist solely in cyberspace that you can join or leave as you see fit. And the more people who join, the more valuable and secure that those rights and the attached monetary unit to them become. Because the Bitcoin unit itself is simply a unit of account that grants you access to the assurances provided by all of the other elements of the system. I don't see how you could claim that even one of those doesn't have value. But all of them combined? Within a single network? As he says, as Jeffrey Tucker says in this, is that the value is in the system, is in how this system provides assurances of all of these other utilities, all of these other values, and that this open source public ledger keeps track of these ownership rights and permits us to transfer and prove them, essentially. Bitcoin managed to combine this with a unit of account so that the exchange system, the bank, and the job of the bank and the Fedwire system to modify, to write, and to execute these contracts is within the actual rules of the rights, the titles, the exchanges, and the contracts. They are attached to each other irrevocably. One cannot exist without the other. And like he said, it ended up solving what was perceived as and taught as for a very long time as an impossible problem, the Byzantine general's problem. Is that how do you achieve consensus when you know you cannot trust maybe all or at least some of your counterparties that you're communicating with? How can we at the end of the day agree on one truth when we can't trust any one individual explicitly within the group? That alone is a breakthrough. And when we're talking about Mises' regression theorem, this is such a fun topic because, I mean, I think Jeffrey Tucker's totally right in this piece, is that it absolutely meets the regression theorem, the regression theorem's criteria, I guess you could say, is that, and what's funny is that when you go back to just the unit of account before while people are doing transactions. That's actually, like I said at the beginning of this, is that's one of the most interesting takeaways, is that we do know the commodity use of Bitcoin as a unit of account because it was that value, or it was that price for 10 full months. Of course, just a digital unit, an empty point on a computer screen, is of no value, and it had the price of zero for 10 months. But in doing so, people were testing out the architecture of the system. They were testing out the economic system. They were testing out the monetary policy. Where's the quote, actually? He like goes through here and like hits a whole bunch of these. Here it is. So, did it transfer the units without double spending? Did a system that depended on voluntary CPU power actually suffice to verify and confirm transactions? In other words, did the security model actually pan out to, enforce an economic incentive to continue to go into the future and disincentivize or prevent attackers from altering it? Do the rewarded Bitcoins land in the right spot as payment for verification services? And most of all, did this new system actually work to do the seemingly impossible? That is, to move secure bits of title-based information through geographic space, not by using some third party, but rather peer-to-peer. They were testing out all the assurances of the system. How well does the court actually go by the written language of the contract? How well does it enforce the proper title, the proper owner of the property title? How well does it remain independent in the presence of a government actor, a malicious piece of code, or an ignorant attacker, or a bad client, or whatever it is that is trying to fudge with the rules of the system? How well are those financial laws and monetary laws defined within the system? Can they be cheated, or are they secure in spite of everyone being able to freely enter and leave the network itself? How well does it solve the double spending problem? Can people rehypothecate and send Bitcoin that don't exist to somebody? Is there any Bitcoin created outside of the explicit schedule of inflation rate? Do they move to the right owner when that contract is rewritten and sent to a new location? All of these things have immense value if they work. And it turns out they did on Bitcoin. They did very, very well. And as soon as it achieved any amount of price, because in order to have all of those assurances, in order to test all of those assurances, you had to acquire some. As soon as it carried a price, all the rest is history. Everything else doesn't matter, because that is the point in which you can now securely own a contract to a title to a piece of value, and you can send that to anyone anywhere in the world. And it becomes circular after that. And the network values, networks in themselves. So this is actually another point that I could have probably added to my list of all the other things that Bitcoin is. It's also a network in and of itself, like a communications network. So an analogy that I really like to give is that a network is useless when nobody's on it. Like, so the network might be revolutionary. Like Facebook might be a groundbreaking technology and hold all of this massive potential as a social media network. The phone may be massively useful, and holy crap, it's so much better than the telegraph. I don't have to, you know, Morse code you some message through somebody else. I can just pick up a thing, hold it to my face, and speak, and you hear it on the other end. But as a network, it's only valuable because of the number of people that are on it. So the first user of Facebook and the first person with a phone in their house has paid for something that has no value whatsoever because its value is a network-based value. Like, the idea of Facebook is that I can share something with someone else on the network. If I'm the only one on the network, I can't share anything. I can't send them a message. I can't look at their wall. There is nothing for me to look at. Same with a phone. If I'm the only person in the world with a phone, the purpose of a phone is to communicate with somebody else. Is to be able to call and send my voice over a communications line straight to their ear if nobody else has a phone, I can't call anybody. In that same way, Bitcoin, the property title, is of no use if nobody else thinks it's valuable or is putting their exchanging their value for that title. The contract is the settlement of that contract in the court of Bitcoin is of no value, even if I know it's honest, even if I know it cannot be corrupted, even if I know the bank itself, the institution, can't go insolvent, even if I know it's audited, if nobody else is going to take the other side of that contract. As the sole person who values and holds Bitcoin, I have nothing of value because the value is being able to use it as a communication tool. But I can value it today under the assumption that other people will see and recognize what would happen if they too joined the network. How much better it would be if they were using phones instead of Morse code. How much better it would be if they were using social media as opposed to email. How much better it would be if we were together using the assurances, the objective contractual language, the public ledger of ownership, the rock-solid monetary policy, the settlement and exchange system secured by literally the most powerful global distributed supercomputer ever created by man, and the perfectly scarce, impossible to inflate monetary unit we call Bitcoin that's attached to it all. It doesn't take a whole lot of imagination to see how much more efficient and capable the market could be by having that entire structure of guarantees, plus the ocean of things that we could build on top of it. The actual global and scalable retail payment systems that actually grant an additional layer of privacy and the additional just privacy protocols that we can attach to it or use within it. The real world property titles that we could attach to it. Any of the other applications that we could lock to these property titles with literally nothing more than a hash, and the entirely independent, central bank absent, extra governmental financial system that we could then build on top of it. And all you have to do is recognize a little piece of that, and you understand it might actually be worth something to have a little bit of this thing. And of course, it's perfectly scarce. So in order to actually participate in this and to get those assurances with any amount of value that you put into the system, you got to have the unit. It's really hard to exaggerate how valuable the network itself could actually become, especially when we're already finding ourselves moving into the next layer. That this thing will actually be able to scale, even though the underlying blockchain did have incredible limitations and trade-offs with the, and this is one of those things, it goes back to so many of the problems and the philosophical differences between something like Bcash and BSV against Bitcoin, is that hard forks break all of these assurances. All of this only works because the consensus rules have remained consistent and they have proven that the property titles are in fact secure, that the double spending can't actually happen, and that the security model, as written, does actually survive the test of time. The code that enforces all of those elements of the system itself is why those guarantees provide integrity. It's why the integrity of those guarantees exist in the first place. It's because it has a low attack surface. It's because there was no avenue to put in a consensus bug, to put in that social layer, to break the objectivity and force it back into the subjective social layer, which is what doing a hard fork every 6 months exactly does to the network, is it just makes it another thing run by humans where all the most critical consensus rules aren't decentralized and independent. They're just up to the say of a handful of people in the network. The consensus is the network. It is the integrity guarantees. It is the proof that the security is actually still intact. It's the proof that there's no leader pulling the strings somewhere that gets to alter those property titles. The very lack of a consensus break is how we know the security model has continued to work. It's one of the most critical reasons why we know that a Bitcoin property title from 10 years ago is still the property of the original creator of that title. And that's not true for almost any other network at this point, that the title itself is who decides owner, that almost every one of them has had some sort of a hard fork that is confiscated or altered the rules of who owns what within the network based on a small group of people. The DAO, the BCH hard fork with the SegWit coins, the DAA, the difficulty adjustment algorithm, and the disaster they had right after the time. I mean, that's at the very heart of the security model. And they're just fudging, they're just completely just screwing up the code and being like, well, let's just arbitrarily change that. You can't have to wonder if that's the case. There are no assurances if you don't even know if the fundamental security and the fundamental code is actually going to enforce any of it, or if we're just going to arbitrarily change the rules because it would be really convenient if we did this time. Then the title's not worth anything, and therefore neither is the unit. And unfortunately, there's a very explicit trade-off with scaling. The more information you pack into it, the harder it is to verify that any of those assurances have actually been met. There's another really great piece that I've read on the show many, many, many years ago. It's called many episodes ago. Hell, it's probably 2 years ago. The Bitcoin is an accounting revolution. It was episode or read 255. And it talks about the move from single entry accounting to double entry accounting, and now to the invention of triple entry accounting and the assurances, the guarantees that you can get from being able to publicly audit the system and having an architecture where you can know without a doubt what version of the system everyone else is looking at. But it is explicitly because we can audit it ourselves that we know we've solved the Byzantine generals problem, that we know we're looking at the exact same thing. So as soon as the entire system, as soon as all of the data within the system is too much information to actually check on your typical computing system, on your typical user actually has at their disposal, they do have to trust somebody else. They are trusting someone else that the rules have actually been adhered to. And what defines a Bitcoin is the rules under which it was created, which means that the only way to be absolutely certain that the Bitcoin you receive is real Bitcoin, is actually Bitcoin under the current atomic structure of the consensus rules, is to go all the way back to when that Bitcoin was mined in a block and verify that the entire chain from the very start to your wallet is in fact following all of the rules. And then you check every other chain of signatures and the accounting of everybody else's coins in the network. You check the whole thing, and then you know that the monetary policy is also secure. So not only did your Bitcoins follow the entire rule set of Bitcoin and were created validly in the valid chain from start to finish, but now you can actually check that every other piece of, like as if you were checking every other piece of gold on the planet for its actual, for it being real gold, atomic structure, all the way through to the center of the coin or the bar or the bullion, whatever it is, you're checking all of it so that you know the whole system hasn't been compromised, whether or not your coins are in fact real. But that means that you have to have access and you have to be able to actually do the math. You have to actually do the computation on all of that data. Otherwise, you're letting someone else do it, and you're just trusting their stamp. We're back to the banking system, where the bank stamps the coin, and you just hope, you trust, that they did the work for you. And that's why the trade-off between scaling and all of the integrities, the assurances, the value of the property title, the independence of the court, the security of the monetary policy, the lack of ambiguity of the language of the contract, all of those things are secure, and all of those things are unbelievably high in assurance. specifically because there's not much data to check. It's very easy to prove that all of that has executed exactly as it should be. But when you start talking about cramming gigabytes of data into that layer, what you do is you crowd the court system that has undeniable property rights with essentially so many court cases that you can't check the judge's work, that it goes right back to a trusted system. Like if I had to audit all the information that was being uploaded to YouTube, they get like terabytes of data being uploaded to YouTube every minute. Every minute. That literally means that the only person with a big enough computer to actually audit all of that information is Google. That's it. They are the only ones. They're pretty much it. If there was a set of rules that that information had to go by, nobody could check their work. And the cost of doing so would be so exorbitant that they wouldn't do it anyway. It wouldn't be worthwhile. Now, if you take one of those contracts and you extend it into a payment system, you build an entirely new architecture on top of that that settles in the Bitcoin court and keeps the court system easily auditable, the judges under unbelievable scrutiny, and the laws and consensus rules, the Constitution, the property titles, all of that themselves, with thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of referees confirming beyond any shadow of a doubt that it was perfectly fair, it perfectly adhered to the rules, and all the math from start to finish is a yes and not a no. Then you can build and attach thousands of payment systems on top of this thing that settle to this incontestable non-government financial court. And you know, I would contest one other thing in this article, just aside from that general language thing that I've kind of harped on for most of this, most of the guy's take here, is about the nature of why so many people in the world are poor and do not have access to a payment system or banking services and that sort of thing. So here's the quote that I've got here is, quote, "The hitch is that the payment systems we have today are not available to just anyone. In fact, a vast majority of humanity does not have access to such tools, which is a major reason for poverty in the world. The financially disenfranchised are confined to only local trade and cannot extend their trading relationships with the world." I would say that this actually has it backwards. It's not the lack of access to the financial system that causes poverty. The poverty is why they can't get access to the financial system. But the underlying root of that poverty is the lack of property rights. It prevents capital from accumulating. It prevents the ability to deal with people, like he said, outside of their local area. It prevents growth from actually being sustainable, for it to stick and stay and compound on itself. It keeps it unprofitable to provide financial services and banking services to them. That's what makes it impossible to successfully run some sort of a financial service industry for countries in the third world, for these poor countries and stuff. They're either going to get confiscated by the governments. They're going to be completely controlled and corrupted by the political and, you know, regulatory hijacked institutions of those areas. The overhead in infrastructure is going to be way more than any potential return that they would make from the impoverished population. And the identity and reputation market is not established enough for them to even do so without greater risk than they take everywhere else they provide those services. So you've literally got a higher cost, a higher risk, and a lower return than you would get from just providing those financial services to middle-class America. I think that is far more a consequence of the lack of property rights and legal stability in business and trade agreements within those countries. I mean, you look at what the problems of those countries are, and I think it's pretty obvious that that's the case. If the financial services could actually set up and know they could consistently do business with a a consistent and incontestable set of rules, they could actually obtain capital. They could build on top of the capital they already have, and they could continue and broaden their business relationships and make services, financial services, and payment systems actually available to those populations. But we need a consistent and common set of rules that we can both trust in order to even begin that task. So before the final word here, and we close this out, I just want to say one more thank you to our awesome sponsors for today's podcast. That is Hexa Mobile Wallet. It is a non-custodial wallet, and they are in beta. So they love to get any feedback. And if you want to start playing around with it, go to guyswan.com/Hexa. Tons of features already and tons more to come. And then, of course, the Bitbox O2, one of the, if not the easiest to use and a highly secure hardware wallet for your Bitcoin cold storage. If you were holding any substantial amount in Bitcoin, you've got to get a solid hardware wallet. And Bitbox is an amazing wallet for exactly that role. Go to guyswan.com/Bitbox to check them out. And lastly, Levvl.co, LVL.co, a no-fee Bitcoin exchange and full-on banking and debit services with Bitcoin. This is going to be huge, and you should definitely check it out. They're available in 28 states, and hopefully it's one of yours, and fingers crossed it'll be coming to mind very soon. Thank you to those guys for supporting Bitcoin Audible. And of course to Iyer and Jeffrey Tucker for all of the incredible work that he does. He's been really a major element in my understanding of like economic history and the origins of money. And he just really is such a good resource. And overall, he's just a really good guy. So thanks to Jeffrey Tucker for writing this piece and spreading the good word about Bitcoin. And you know, what we need to make the world a better place to, that sounds so cliche, to solve some of the biggest problems in the world today. And he says this also in the piece, is that one of the core problems that Bitcoin solves is the problem of inflationary monetary creation beyond which the protocol permits. That strict monetary rules were 100% followed, and that there is no leader dictating or arbitrarily changing what those rules are. That is the utter groundbreaking innovation that this system has enabled. And in doing so, it has secured a set of rules about ownership, a set of explicit and easily defined property rights that is rock solid, that cannot be contested, that is global, that cannot be censored, and cannot be corrupted. And that is what Bitcoin is. And with it, we will solve so many other problems by building on top of it. And somebody who thinks that that doesn't have any value just has their eyes closed. This is Bitcoin Audible, and I am Guy Swan, and I will catch you all on tomorrow's episode. And until then, take it easy, guys. This has been a 111 production, and you were listening to Bitcoin Audible on the Crypto Economy Network.